Coming up on Weekend America.
In America, 4th of July is a celebration. But in Iraq...
4th of July in Iraq sucked. A lot of days in Iraq sucked, but I think holidays are especially tough because you know that so much is going on back home and you're stuck sweating your butt off in a war zone getting shot at.
At war on Independence Day. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, Shelley thought it was just a day water skiing on the lake.
I saw something, but, you know, I'm not going to tell you it was peppy, but I'm not going to tell you it wasn't.
One town searches for a magical sea monster that fetches tourists. And sometimes the biggest mystery is why people base their lives around puzzles.
When I looked at graduate schools, certainly I didn't base my decision entirely on going to the mystery hunt, but it was involved.
Need a hint about when Weekend America is coming up?
Right after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America in St. Paul. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe in for Bill Radke. Welcome to a somewhat mysterious hour of our program. Coming up, we're going to Lake Pepin, Minnesota, in search of a sea monster named Peppy. There's a $50,000 reward if you can solve the mystery of what's out there in the water. Kind of spooky, I guess, but, you know, how can you be all that scared of a monster named Peppy? And later, mysteries that only the most nimble and strongest of brains can even come close to at the MIT Mystery Hunt. And what's a mystery you've solved recently?
Why there's always cops in front of my apartment. I didn't realize they do maintenance on the police cars right across the street.
Oh, I got my laptop to stop doing this one weird thing. I just kind of pressed a bunch of buttons and hoped for the best.
I found a lot of things. I've wondered where they've been for a semester or two.
I helped my niece solve a math problem.
I've solved the mystery of which takes longer to get back up to my neighborhood, the brown line or the red line. I'm going to go with the red line.
The socks in the dryer.
You solved
what
it?
What happens to them? No, I need somebody to
okay.
help me.
I was going to say, I was going to bring you a Nobel Prize right now if you cracked that code. Those voices came to us from Chicago and from Morgantown, West Virginia.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
We hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
We've been bringing you a series, This Weekend in 1968, stories about what was happening in the United States exactly 40 years ago. This 4th of July weekend, nearly 180,000 soldiers are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. 40 years ago in South Vietnam, a little more than 500,000 soldiers were fighting. This weekend, we talked to veterans of Vietnam and Iraq. We wanted to find out what the 4th of July is like for a soldier who's been to war. And we wanted to know what it was like both then and now.
I'm Ed Vick. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served with the Navy's River Patrol Force in Vietnam in 1968.
My name is Paul Rykoff. I served with the U.S. Army in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. As a rifle platoon leader with the 3rd Infantry and 1st Armored Divisions.
The 4th of July in Vietnam was just like every other day. You know, when you're there in the middle of it, it's not so much about patriotism. Things like the 4th of July and, you know, it had a lot less meaning than they would have to a civilian.
4th of July in Iraq sucked. A lot of days in Iraq sucked, but I think holidays are especially tough because you know that so much is going on back home and you're stuck sweating your butt off in a war zone getting shot at. So I think it was especially tough for my unit because we were told after the initial invasion that we'd be home by the 4th of July. So I remember writing a letter home to my brother saying, hey, 4th of July is coming up. Looking forward to going to a Yankee game with you. We'll drink a cold beer, hang out, you know, check out the fireworks. I didn't think it would be the same type of fireworks I ended up seeing in Baghdad for the next couple of months.
Every day and every night was a huge stress mentally, just like it is, I think, for these guys and women in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we would go out at dusk in these 35-foot patrol boats, and we would usually sort of set up our boats and, you know, just shut everything down, and we just sat there all night long by the light of the stars. pretty much everywhere you were at risk. You're taking it easy, and all of a sudden mortars start coming in. You know, the whole riverbank erupts in gunfire, and you just never know where it's coming from. You're going out at night, and you're getting ready to go, and the sun's going down, it's getting dark, and you just sort of go through your mind, I said, I wonder if I'm going to die tonight. And then you just sort of say, well, what the hell, let's go.
Our days in Iraq were pretty chaotic. If there was an average day, it was usually spent working 18 to 20 hours a day looking for insurgents, doing a ton of searches through homes and businesses, looking for weapons caches, and thinking about all the possibilities that can happen so you're prepared. Whether it's a car bomb or a sniper or a kid with a grenade in his hand, you're just trying to think about all the possibilities constantly. One of my old soldiers told me once that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not trying to kill you. You know, my lasting memory of the average day in Iraq is walking with my guys through the narrow streets, you know, sweating with a ton of gear, waiting to get blown up.
I remember getting ready to go out on a patrol one day. You know, this petty officer comes in and says that one of his guys just can't go out. The officer said, what do you mean he can't go out? He just can't go out. He just can't go out anymore. He can't do it. It was viewed as a disgrace. He got no treatment whatsoever. And he was mustered out of the service with, I think it was called a discharge other than honorable. It wasn't dishonorable, but it was other than honorable. And that's what happened to a lot of people who, in these days, would be seen as having post-traumatic stress.
There were a couple of moments that really, I think, were tough emotionally and mentally. But Christmas Eve, our sergeant major was killed in a roadside attack. And the sergeant major is the senior enlisted guy for, you know, a few hundred folks. And he's kind of like the, you know, the grandpa bear for all the soldiers in the unit. And when he was killed on Christmas Eve, that was really tough hit on morale. And my unit had been extended, three or four times already. The number of divorces in my unit had stacked up. Guys were getting wounded. The insurgency was really starting to grow, and we had had enough. You know, it was time to be out of there. I think part of the emotional impact of this war that's unique is that you don't know when you're coming home. I mean, you kind of hope that your higher headquarters will at least tell you, you know, amidst all this chaos and carnage and frustration and the flood of emotions, that at least you could pick a day where you know you'll be coming home and you can plan the rest of your life. And I think it's an especially tough part of this war that's unique and that's different from Vietnam. When we found out we were coming home, we didn't believe it at all. I mean, we had been told we were coming home 5-6 times prior to that, and the rug got jerked out from under us. So, you know, when we finally got to that point where we were flying out of Baghdad, the guys actually were giddy. It was like they had, you know, they all smoked weed before they went on the plane or something. And I remember at some point a pillow fight broke out, like the most random thing. We were on the corkscrew plane going up, and the guys just started throwing pillows at each other, these cheap airline pillows that somehow the Air Force got. And then, you know, it kind of just started to sink in. But when you finally come home, it's just a total overwhelming flood of emotion. You know, the families are waiting for you there at the parade field, and it's almost surreal.
I'll tell you how I came home. I was patrolling up near the Cambodian border, and we were on a night patrol. We had some contact with some North Vietnamese, you know, a little bit of a firefight. It wasn't anything terrible. You know, the sun was coming up, and we took our boats in, took a shower, got my gear packed. A chopper came in, took me to Saigon, and within 24 hours, I was in Philadelphia. And that was it. When I got back, I couldn't get a job. I was like a highly educated naval officer, and nobody cared. I could barely get a job. I moved to Texas because I thought that I would be more respected there because it's more of a right-wing state. And I got a job finally as a bill collector. It's about the best I could do. And I went back to graduate school. I went to Northwestern. And the very first day I drove on campus, there was a demonstration. They were burning books and desks and everything right in the street. And they were protesting the war.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
So I knew enough to not really talk about having been in Vietnam. My first day in class, the professor was going around saying, let's everybody introduce themselves, tell a little bit about yourself. So I said that, you know, where I'd gone to college, and that's about all I said. He was a reserve naval officer himself, and so he said, oh, you're forgetting something. Tell us about where you were for the past year. So I sort of said something like, I was in Vietnam for a year and I just got back. And there was sort of silence around the room. And for several months thereafter, no one in this class would speak to me. No one would say hello. No one would say goodbye. I was completely ostracized by people I didn't even know for no reason other than I had been a Vietnam veteran.
My first week, I was in Georgia at Fort Stewart, and we had about a week of out-processing. And I knew that if I came right back to New York City, it would be too much for me. I needed some time away from my family. I needed some time to just unwind my mind. And my girlfriend drove my Jeep down to Fort Stewart, where she met me, and we spent about a week and a half just driving around Florida and staying in little hotels by the beach and just trying to absorb being home. I remember wireless internet was something that like didn't really exist before I left. And I came back and like blogs and all this new music and all this stuff that happened while I was gone that just seemed like I was, you know, Rip Van Winkle, and I woke up and all that stuff had gone on.
Yeah.
But I remember that the week I got home, the biggest story in America was Janet Jackson's exposed breast at the Super Bowl. And it was kind of jarring to me to come home and say, wow, this is what people are focused on. This is what people are talking about. The apathy is what really hits me in the gut. I have a good friend who got home in 2004 and called me 2 weeks ago and said, I am really messed up. I need to see somebody. It took 4 years, and his girlfriend left him, and he said, I never realized it. I never realized how much pain I was in. I never realized how much I was going through until 4 years after coming home. Thank God he got to that point. For some people, it might take 40 years.
Most Iraq veterans say, and you'll hear this a lot, is that I don't want to be another Vietnam veteran. It's hard for me to hear that because, for all my experience, I'm a relatively high-functioning Vietnam veteran. And I know exactly what they mean because I've spent a lot of time trying to help those kind of Vietnam veterans. And, I hope as much as they do that the ones who say, I don't want to end up like a Vietnam veteran, I hope they're right.
Our series, This Weekend in 1968, is produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler, with some help from Tiffany Haynes. And special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for their archival tape. There's more stories, lots of web extras, at our website, weekendamerica.org.
I was reading something in the Oregonian, the Portland newspaper, about 4th of July being kind of complicated for veterans who suffer from PTSD, because there's fireworks and then there's also alcohol, summer heat, and crowds and traffic. It's all these stressful situations for these people and these things that they've already been through, and then add in the fireworks and the noise.
Yeah, I can only imagine. We don't even think about that when we're out there enjoying the fireworks. And then even if you don't go to fireworks, they're setting them off in the backyard.
Right.
So
you hear them no matter what.
Exactly. There's no way to get away from that. You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Your boss wants you to get him coffee, you refuse. You're fired. You sue. The court fines for your boss. Good news, bad news, or no news, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe alongside Desiree Cooper. A lot of things happen over the course of the week, and they are complicated. They are nuanced. They are multidimensional, and we do not wish that to stand. We like to break things down into three simple categories in this part of the show: good news, bad news, or no news. To help us along on that task, we have assembled a crack team. Author, Hollywood mogul John Ridley is with us. Hi, John.
How are you?
Good, thanks. Public radio host of The Sound of Young America, Jesse Thorne. Hi, Jesse.
Howdy do.
And Yale University professor of literature, Amy Hungerford. Hello, Amy.
Good day, John.
Wow, very Ivy League there.
I thought I should live up to that.
This week, Barack Obama set off on what was being called a patriotism tour. He spent the week traveling to traditionally Republican areas of the country. It's an effort to counter assertions and rumors that he won't say the Pledge of Allegiance or put his hand over his heart during the national anthem. Obama patriotism tour. Good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's very good news. What interests me here is he's not just playing the symbolism of patriotism in the campaign. He's actually talking about the assumptions behind what we think patriotism is. And this is what I like about Obama. He did this with race in his famous speech about that subject. And here he's taking on the assumptions. What does it mean to be patriotic? What does it mean to respect someone else's military service? What does it mean to sacrifice for your country? And he's talking about those things rather than just playing off the symbolism of them.
John, what do you think?
I think here's what I'm excited about is after he gets done with this patriotism tour, he's also going to go on the Bigfoot Exists tour to really put the nail in the coffin of that rumor. I think it's bad news. I think it plays into these rumors that have started that he's unpatriotic. And I would say as a person of color, speaking of another person of color, I'm tired of having to defend my patriotism, my citizenship, my right to be involved in the political process, and all these things that we've had to do since we were dropped off, you know, and had our teeth checked after the Middle Passage. So it bothers me that he's both playing into this trap and that it is not – his playing into it was intellectualized rather than from the gut and from the heart and more forceful towards the people who are bringing up these non-controversies about his patriotism.
Well, I think after the Swift boat experience with Kerry, I think he's right to be cautious about squelching these things because these things have their effects.
But I think if you're really going to take the fight to him, go, look, we've had the conservative presidents, your Nixons and your Reagans, who've worn their flag pins while they've danced all over the Constitution. I'm sorry I'm not wearing a flag pin, but is that the new metrics for being an American? Are we going to walk down the streets of a city and point at the people who don't have their flag pins on? I'm going to actually defend the Constitution.
Okay, I'll vote for John.
I'll start wearing my Evel Knievel suit.
You bring up a lot of good points, John, and it makes me wonder about this question. Can I borrow your Evel Knievel suit?
No.
I think we'd all vote for John Ridley in an Evel Knievel costume. Well, let's move along. In Pennsylvania, a receptionist who refused to fetch coffee for her boss was fired. She then took the firing to court, where the judge recently ruled against her, saying that it didn't constitute a hostile or discriminatory workplace. It's just a cup of coffee, but in terms of power structure in a work environment, it can mean so much more. Is the judge's ruling, which pretty much says, quit crying, you baby, and go get your boss some coffee, good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I live here in Los Angeles, so I have to say no news. Basically, Los Angeles work hierarchies are just a structure of who is an assistant to whom. And basically, they draw the line somewhere after sending your assistant to get your colonoscopy done for you. So there's really nothing that could shock me in the world of asking your secretary to do something.
Well, people have the power to agree to do a job that's explained to them and offered to them, and they have their chance to say yay or nay. And if things are defined up front, I have no problem with this ruling.
So is this a good situation that the courts got involved with this?
I think the overall situation is good news because how refreshing is it that we finally found in a male-dominated workforce the one remaining woman who is so naive and unharassed that she thinks getting coffee is degrading.
That's a sign of progress, that she was shocked that she had to go do that.
I feel bad for the boss who has to go home and say, look, I never called her the B word. You know, I never ask her to stay over and massage my feet. None of that. But I'm a bad guy because I said, hey, could you grab some coffee for me on my way to into this meeting? I feel bad for that guy.
Let's move along. That distant, happy sound you hear is the joyous laughter of the childless. In a Newsweek article widely circulated this week, writer Lorraine Ali gathers together the findings of several studies indicating that married couples without kids tend to be happier and have stronger marriages than those of us cursed with the miracle of children. Kids making you miserable, good news, bad news, or no news?
I know for a fact that it's bad news for me. I'm childless right now, but I'm already a pretty sad, pathetic man. I ate a gallon of ice cream with a fork last night because I didn't want to run the dishwasher.
Wow.
Ooh,
there's so many things that are wrong with that.
Well, John and Amy, you are both childful, correct?
I have children, yes.
Yeah, this is no news. I mean, yeah. You know, it's Independence Day. It's enshrined in our Constitution, the pursuit of happiness. But the pursuit of happiness is not actually the most important thing that I do in my life. And when you're trying to do a hard thing, you're not going to be happy at every moment during that process. But at the end of it, hopefully you're happy.
John, do you think you're less happy than you would be without kids?
No, I think this is bad news because I have to say I used to be the bitter guy who would eat the ice cream with the fork and not run the dishwasher. And I have to say, honestly, and I joke about a lot of the other things that we talk about and stuff, but I've never been as happy as when I've had my boys. They are my best friends and I love it. So I think it's bad news that other people are not in the moment happy with their children or thinking that, and I'm not directing this at Amy in any way, even though she's the one who said this, you know, that down the road, you're going to be happy, you know, at some point, or, you know, it's difficult, so I can't be happy. I'm happy now.
How old are your kids, John?
They're 5 and 8.
Yes, yeah, you're in the sweet spot. I'm entering the sweet spot. Mine are 4 and 6. Let's have this conversation, John, again when your kids are teenagers. And
when the hatred and animosity really kicks in.
Amy is a wonderful, wonderful person. Amy, you're wonderful. But it's just those East Coast intellectuals that cannot actually feel joy in their heart. We see it time and time again.
Amy wants to read a book about joy.
The closest thing Amy can get to joy is if she discovers a really tasty caper at the Whole Foods.
Hey, look, I really do kiss my children on the forehead once every day. I really do.
Do you shake their hands before you send them off to school?
No, that's going too far, man.
I have my assistant kiss my children.
That's nice.
Well, that's the news this week. Panel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy 4th of July weekend. I say that as a patriotic American.
Are you wearing a flag pin, John?
My Evel Knievel suit is going on now.
John Ridley's latest book is The American Way. Amy Hungerford is a professor of literature at Yale. Jesse Thorne is the host of the radio show The Sound of Young America.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Japanese Americans remember when their freedom hinged on their answer to two questions. Coming up on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with John Moe. It's time for your letters. On last week's show, we featured Tyrus Wong. The 97-year-old goes out every fourth Saturday of the month to the beaches in Santa Monica, and he paints the sky with his kites. Luann Sweeney lives in Randolph, Massachusetts, and she says the story reminds her of a life of a single mom two decades ago. She said, "Buying, putting together, and getting a kite into the air gave me faith that I could do anything." The story brings back that feeling.
2 weeks ago, we aired a story about a former drug agent who is now on the opposite side in the war on drugs. Marcia Bryant listens to us in Cleveland, Ohio. She says she admires his civil disobedience.
This former narcotics agent is breaking a law that he feels is unjust. That's what people were doing in the 60s when they sat at segregated lunch counters, and pro-choice people did it with the Jane Network.
Now, many of you shared Marcia's sentiments, but then many of you didn't. Cullen Tanner listens to us in Andover, Minnesota.
The number of comments related to legalization of marijuana is really disturbing. Not that there's anything wrong with the position, but because the story had nothing to do with legalization. This story is about a man who is aiding criminals. Whether or not these people ought to be classified as such is not the point. We don't break laws just because we find them inconvenient or distasteful.
Also 2 weeks ago, John brought a story about his life experiences and how they eventually dictate your entertainment choices. Well, that story struck a chord with Michael Verderami. He listens to us in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
I thank John Moe for describing his personal story and how it caused him to look at the world differently. We're all enriched when someone is willing to share such intimate and personal experiences and feelings. That said, I can't help but reflect on the fact that his enlightenment came only after his personal life was deeply impacted by the two events he recounts for us. Would Mr. Moe need to have a child with autism before he would be sensitive to my youngest child, whose quirky behavior sets him apart from others his age? Would he need to spend time paralyzed in a wheelchair before he appreciates the accomplishments of a very impressive young woman I know who recently earned her PhD in biomedical science? Why is it so hard for us to be empathetic to the struggles of others until we have been personally impacted? And yet I'm hopeful for the future. I am hopeful every time I see one of my son's regular classmates help him out playing kickball. I am hopeful every time I see the grace and dedication of the regular middle school kids and high school kids who volunteer to be one-on-one buddies to our local TOPS soccer team. TOPS is a national youth soccer program for kids with special needs. Perhaps, just perhaps, we can look forward to the time when the idea different no longer means target. For my son's sake, and for Mr. Moe's daughter's sake, we can only hope.
That was the end of Michael's letter, but he also had this to say about parenting.
I think like any parent of a child with special needs, there's a part of me that lives in fear about what the real world holds for him down the future. I haven't had to help my young son when somebody reacts poorly to him yet. I hope I don't, but I know that's probably coming, and I just hope I'm ready when it happens. I think we need to keep speaking out when we see folks treating others poorly because they're different. I think silence is probably the biggest enemy of acceptance for folks who have these kinds of challenges. At least for me personally, you know, I've never supported movies that use the differences of folks to make fun of people. And I don't know if we'll ever be able to get beyond that, but certainly there are comedians I find terribly funny who don't take that approach. One of my personal favorites is Bill Cosby, but even somebody like George Carlin, who has a pretty blue side at times, wasn't picking on other people. He was picking on language in a way that made us laugh and think about who we are. I like to think about those kinds of possibilities as a way to make fun of our lives and not make fun of people.
We love hearing from you. Send us a letter or a comment while spending time at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From St. Paul, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, along with Desiree Cooper. There's a farmer's market today in Lake City, Minnesota, on the shores of Lake Pepin. It's a popular getaway spot for folks from Wisconsin and Minnesota. Folks will be buying produce, socializing, hanging out, and some might be staring really hard at the water, looking for a ripple, maybe a fin, perhaps a monstrous, slimy head of some sort. Lake Pepin is kind of a unique place. It's not really a lake, just a wide part of the Mississippi River, but it has a lot to offer. You can water ski. It's where water skiing was invented, actually. There's great fishing. Some of the fish weigh up to 200 pounds. Majestic views of nearby cliffs. And if you like spooky tales of creatures hitherto unexplained by science, they got that too.
It was about 25 years ago, probably. My brother and some friends were out in a bay north of town water skiing, and I was in the water and saw something surface by the boat. It was as long as the boat. It was a 16-foot boat. It was black. It was ugly. It was long. Serpent-like, I would say.
That's Shelley Shimbano. She manages the Chickadee Cottage Tea Room and Restaurant.
Well, I saw something, but, you know, I'm not going to tell you it was peppy, but I'm not going to tell you it wasn't.
That's right, Peppy. As Loch Ness has Nessie, Lake Pepin has Peppy, or at least stories of Peppy, like the ones told by Larry Nielsen.
We were the only boat out there. The lake was smooth as glass. And we saw a wake about a foot and a half, 2 feet high, and probably about 200 feet long, going down the lake.
Larry is into Peppy lore. He says local Native American tribes refused to go out on the lake in thin canoes because of monsters that lurked in the water. And then there's this.
On April 28, 1871, the Minnesota State Historical Society has an entry in their almanac book of days. It says a lake monster is seen swimming on Lake Pepin.
And now, 137 years later, Larry wants your help finding Peppy. The job pays well.
Well, the reward is a $50,000 reward. You have to have a picture of Peppy along with some sort of sample off of Peppy, like a snippet of a fin or something like that, so that we can send up to the University of Minnesota Biology Department.
It's an offer that's getting attention from all over the world, even though there's no evidence to suggest that there are sea monsters in Lake Pepin, to which Larry says,
There's no evidence to suggest that there's not sea monsters either.
Larry will even let you stay at his place while you try to collect the prize. Of course, Larry's place is a hotel on the lake that he owns, and he will charge you. He can also take you out on the lake in a boat that he owns. He'll charge you for that, too.
We know that Peppy's never harmed anybody, so he must be a pretty nice creature. Probably doesn't have big fangs or anything. He's probably got kind of a grinning face, and he's maybe even a vegetarian.
Sounds like he would lend himself well to the type of cartoons that might be printed on T-shirts that are for sale.
Well, you just never know what might happen here in the next couple of months.
Some people in town believe in Peppy, but everyone in town believes in tourism. But Peppy isn't just a publicity stunt. He's a chance to have fun. Sea monsters. Fun.
We have Peppy Chow. It's a delicious snack mix. It's not intended for Peppy, and it's intended for people to munch on while you're looking for Peppy.
Jill Gary runs Treats and Treasures, a little gift shop near the lake.
Have you ever seen Peppy?
No, I have not been fortunate enough to see Peppy, but there's a lot of things I haven't seen, so it doesn't mean it doesn't exist just because I haven't seen it.
Lake City is relying on the fact that you can't prove a negative. They're not banking on Peppy, they're banking on a lack of proof of not Peppy. And they're really banking on it. You can buy a scoop of Peppermint ice cream or stop by the bar for a drink called the Peppy, which involves some sort of blue liqueur in which everyone says is disgusting. There's even a coloring contest at the gas station and bait shop, which is owned by this guy Steve, who swears he's seen Peppy too. But wait a minute. Couldn't Shelley at the cafe have seen something else?
There's apparently 200-pound fish out there. Could you have seen, like, a big fish, maybe two fish?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what, is a sturgeon?
By the way, Shelley's parents own the cafe. If tourists flock to the lake based on her story, the Shimbano family cashes in. Add her to the other two Peppy perpetuators, Steve at the gas station and Larry at the hotel, you have the ingredients of either a fun town-wide shared mythology or a very clever tourism conspiracy.
I have not spoken to Steve or Larry directly about this. So conspiracy theory is thwarted.
Which is exactly what you would say if this was a conspiracy.
I know. But I'm sure Larry and Steve will collaborate on that with me. They will hold up the story.
As conspirators often do.
Yes, you're correct.
In Lake City, Minnesota, and you can't prove that I'm not, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
This weekend, a group of Japanese Americans will be making a pilgrimage to the former Tule Lake Segregation Center in California. This camp was used in World War II to detain Japanese Americans. Now, their loyalty was decided by their answers to questions about their willingness to serve in the military and about their unqualified allegiance to America.
For those who responded with a yes, you know, putting their lives on the line to, you know, join the military, They would really feel offended against those who responded with a no.
That's retired California State Assemblyman George Nakano. He was a resident of Tule Lake as a child, and he says answering no on either question branded you a no-no boy, and that had some serious ramifications. Here are two stories.
My name is Toru Bill Nishimura, number 27. Are you willing to serve in the armed forces of the United States on combat duty wherever ordered? I answered, no. Number 28, will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States of America and faithfully defend the United States from any or all attack by foreign or domestic forces and forswear any form of allegiance or obedience to the Japanese emperor, to any other foreign government, power, or organization? And I answered that in blank and wrote a note underneath stating that when my civil rights is restored, I will answer this question. They assumed that was negative. And so people who answered no at that time, they were sent to Tule Lake. I wasn't really happy to go there because I didn't want to be called a disloyal. I was still an American, and I was just fighting for my civil rights. When I got to Tule Lake, I was just startled. Fenced all around the camp, so many guard towers. Oh, so this is the segregation center, I thought. When the war's end, my concern was being deported to Japan. The greatest news while I was in camp was this announcement. The government, they said, if you wish to go to Japan, well, we won't stop you. But we're not forcing you to go to Japan. I thought to myself, Uncle Sam still has a warm heart for me.
My name is Gene Akutsu. I answered the questions 27 as no and question 28 as yes. They decided to activate the draft in January, I guess it was, and by April, I was one of the first to be called in for induction, which I didn't follow. Then the FBI came and off I went. 3 years, 3 months at the federal prison in McNeil Island. The time that used to get to me was in the daytime. I'd hear the seagulls. I used to get melancholy over that because when I was young, we always lived right close to the sound here, so we'd hear that seagull all the time. And those thoughts would drift through my mind, in and out. I got out in 1946 when my mother passed away. I refer to that as a wartime casualty. When my brother and I made it back home, we found out that the church members had told her, don't come to church anymore. One day, it all got to her, and she took her life. And if she would have only lived one more year longer, we would have had a clemency from the president saying that we are all okay when you have all your citizenship back. That's all she was living for.
Special thanks to Sogi Kashiwagi. You can learn more about Tule Lake and see photos and video. Just visit our website at weekendamerica.org.
High 70s and scattered thunderstorms in Pennsylvania's Bald Eagle State Forest, sunny and 87 in Independence, Missouri, showers and 70 at the base of Mount Adams in Washington State. Do you see the theme?
Got it.
For more weather, here's Weekend America's Stephanie Curtis.
Fort Davis, Texas has sun, 77, and felonies galore. Their weekend-long 4th of July party includes parade, street dance, and two historical bank robbery simulations. Or perhaps actual robberies by clever crooks dressed in period costumes. Plus, a pet parade. Recall the wild, lawless days of the town's past. Imagine putting pets in a parade. Nothing like rounding up the kids and building a sandcastle in South Dakota? The town of Bruce invites fans of both sand and cognitive dissonance to come to a sand sculpture contest made more challenging by high winds plus clouds 86 degrees. Of course, the sand sculpture contest is way easier than the South Dakota Surfing Championships. Speaking of cognitive dissonance, over in Maui, where sandcastles are usually built, they're having a blues festival. The weather plays along, cloudy, windy, and 88 as national and local acts perform. But how can you have the blues in Hawaii? My surfboard done left me. I'm downhearted because there's sand in my umbrella drink. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
Here's a puzzle. Why would people spend a sleepless weekend trying to solve puzzles in order to think up more puzzles for others to solve? Next on Week in America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe with Desiree Cooper. Another three-day weekend is here, so let's revisit our three-day weekend series. Every year, Francis Heaney and Dan Katz spend one of their three-day weekends at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, they're not building robots or looking for spaceships or anything. They're solving puzzles. They're competing in the MIT Mystery Hunt, huge event, the Boston Marathon of puzzle solving. And this year, 1,000 people competed on 45 teams in this event. But perhaps none are as dedicated as Dan and Francis. Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder recently talked with them about why they do it.
To win the Mystery Hunt, all you have to do is find a coin that's hidden somewhere on the MIT campus. Thing is, before you do that, you first have to solve 100 very difficult puzzles. 10 years ago, at Francis Haney and Dan Katz's first mystery hunt, their team made it to the final puzzle, which would, in turn, lead them to the coin.
And we're rushing around, and the final clue directs us to a specific freight elevator. And we get the secret message, floor E.
And what is E?
E is the mathematical constant. Oh, I meant to look up what the actual value of the mathematical constant was, so I wouldn't be exposed as a math sham on the radio.
It's somewhere around 2.72182811. There's a 18281828 in there somewhere.
That's Dan. He's getting his PhD in math at Brown. This is Francis. He edits puzzle books for a living.
I know. I was going to say 2.7, so I wasn't far off.
We had names for guys like this at my high school. Valedictorians.
Anyway, so you needed to get in this elevator.
And somehow place it on the 2.7 floor, or rather 70% of the way between the second and third floor, because that's where the coin was hidden.
So we rush over to this elevator and are dismayed to discover that there is another team in the elevator.
A lot of the other team. 20 to 30 people had been stuffed in the elevator for a while, riding it up and down, looking for the coin.
People were getting kind of claustrophobic and upset about being in the elevator for so long.
But when they heard Dan and Francis's team gathering outside, they didn't want to come out. Then Dan heard someone in the elevator scream.
Not a I'm going to die of not being able to breathe scream, but a oh, I found the coin scream.
Turns out Dan and Francis's team didn't win. They came in second. Which, oddly enough, is better than winning.
Winning the mystery hunt is very exciting, and as soon as the adrenaline wears off, you realize, oh, I've made a terrible error, because winning the mystery hunt means that you have to write next year's mystery hunt with the rest of your team, of course.
Which takes about a year to write, and is just as intense as the hunt, because a mystery hunt puzzle is unlike any other puzzle on the face of the earth. Consider one of this year's puzzles. It asked teams to identify specific words on a shopping mall window. At Disneyland. Or this puzzle, based on the movie, The Matrix.
You uncovered a secret message that said, take the red pill.
Just like Lawrence Fishburne, Morpheus, said in the movie.
You take the red pill, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And when you called in, take the red pill.
That is, when you made a phone call to Mystery Hunt headquarters.
You ended up getting a phone call from Morpheus from The Matrix.
Well, an actor playing him.
And you went on this really neat little chase where you had to go to certain places and answer phones.
And then log into a computer where you received a message that took you to a room where you were asked to literally swallow a red pill. Well, a Tic Tac. And if you did that,
you uncovered a whole other part of the hunt.
You had puzzles that you were solving in the Matrix that changed the answers of puzzles that were outside the Matrix and blah, blah, blah.
And you thought the movie was confusing. Both Dan and Francis have been solving puzzles for as long as they can remember, and both got hardcore about it when they were 10 years old. That's when they were introduced to the most influential puzzle periodical of the day, Games Magazine, edited by none other than puzzle master and public radio celebrity Will Shortz.
I'm going to give you two words.
You know.
Change one letter in each of them.
This guy.
To make two new words that rhyme.
But Dan and Francis would get the adult version of Games Magazine, not the kiddo Games Jr., Katz tells me.
Because Games Jr. was kind of the cutesy puzzles, the rebuses, the find your way through the maze and get to the pony.
Which were the kinds of puzzles I was solving when I was 10.
I wanna be the very best, like no one ever was.
This year, Dan and Francis's team, the Evil Midnight Bombers, What Bomb at Midnight won. So they have to write next year's hunt.
This year, I think we're actually doing pretty well. We picked our theme within less than 2 months, I think.
Something like that. It's Pokemon. If anybody wants to know, it's Pokemon.
So start researching those now.
The mystery hunt is not how most people want to spend a 3-day weekend. It's more of a cerebral Iron Man competition than Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle by the fire.
And that entails, like, not getting a lot of sleep and maybe camping out on a classroom floor in a sleeping bag and eating crap for 3 days and, you know, perhaps letting your personal hygiene slip a little more than you normally would like. And most people just don't want to do that.
But Francis does. And Dan, well, let's put it this way. Dan went to his first mystery hunt when he was a junior in high school. Then he enrolled at MIT, home of the mystery hunt. Now, he's getting a PhD at Brown, which isn't that far away.
When I looked at graduate schools, certainly I didn't base my decision entirely on going to the mystery hunt, but it was involved.
But when you haven't slept in 48 hours, it can be a pretty long drive. I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
This weekend, Dan and Francis are celebrating the 4th of July in Boston and New York, respectively. Pikachu is not expected to join them. Next weekend, the two are attending the National Puzzlers League convention in Denver. You can see photos of this year's mystery hunt at our website, weekendamerica.org.
And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. The show is produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobi, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Tim Bamba, and Angela Kim.
Also, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Christina Pena, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, David Banks, Phyllis Owens, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program. It's all at weekendamerica.org. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. You can collect all of our shows and trade them with other people and watch when they evolve into different shows. Remember, it's your weekend. Get out there and enjoy it. And also, happy birthday to you, America.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. This program is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Summer's here and Weekend America is celebrating. In our new summer travel series, we'll bring you the sounds of vacation.
That is really good. Okay, stop licking your arm. You got bug spray on it. Oh my God, okay, hang on. How is it?
Good.
From camping trips to spa retreats, Weekend America hits the road. And who knows what we'll discover. Join us for the next Weekend America.